What's within you is stronger than what's in your way. You found No Barriers Radio, and I'm your host, Dr. Rhonda Beeman. You can't imagine how many people tell me, because I've written a couple of books, that they have an idea for a book or a screenplay, if only they had the time to write it. It's completely logical why so many of us talk about writing a book and so few do it. When your book is only a theoretical concept, it's the best book ever written, right? Put it down on paper and here comes the problem. You risk realizing you're not good at it, or you can't do it, or you really don't enjoy doing it. You can't fail if you don't do it, right? Today's guest spent 19 years writing a novel. Yeah, you heard me right. 19 years. Dr. Kelly Moreno received his PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Utah. He is currently a professor of psychology, but in his spare time, he wrote a novel. It's called Duty to Betray. And I thought it would be very interesting to talk about a person who for 19 years overcame barriers to finally get his book published. Because I know so many of you have thought about it, or are thinking about it, or know someone who's thinking about writing a book. All right, we have Kelly Moreno here. Are you away from your computer, Kelly? Or are you writing another novel?
Another novel underway that's nearly done. In fact, I'll be on sabbatical next year in order to give it a final rewrite and hopefully get it published like the first one. And then, of course, I've got another dozen ideas that I'd like to get to at some point. So,
well, this first novel, A Duty to Betray, was really, really very easy for you to sit down and pound out, wasn't it, Kelly?
Yep. I just sat down and thought, I think I'll write a novel and get an agent and get a publisher and make millions and go on Oprah and all those things that never happen.
Well, take us back. When did you start this novel, and what was the process like for you?
Well, it was a long time ago. In fact, it was 20 years ago. My wife and I were on our way to Santa Barbara, got into a wicked auto accident. She went through the windshield and subsequently required multiple corrective and cosmetic surgeries. So, and that was in L.A., where she had these done. So we then made multiple trips after that to Los Angeles. And while she was seeing her doctor or in surgery or recovering or whatever, we'd stay at my mother's. My mother at that time had just moved in with George Trammell, who was one of six Superior Court judges in Los Angeles who took all the high-profile cases. In fact, he was scheduled to take the O.J. Simpson trial, but they gave it to Lance Ito, of course, because George is white and Lance wasn't. But anyway, I got to know George while I was waiting for my wife or while she was recovering, and he would spin all these tales about his work as a district attorney and then later as a judge. And they were fascinating to me, and I just thought, God, these are great. So I started taping them, thinking that I would put together a collection of these stories. And so as we continued to, going to L.A., I sat down one day to start typing up George's stories, and it really was wild. I mean, really wild, Rhonda. I had intended to tell George's stories, but when I sat down at the computer, fiction just started leaping off my fingertips, and I had no training in creative writing. I wasn't an English major. I wasn't a journalism major, and yet when I sat down to tell his stories, I just started making all kinds of stuff up, and so it was wild. It was almost an out-of-body experience, and it was great fun. Then the bad news is suddenly my mother's friends start telling her that George is groping them at their at all the cocktail parties that they have, and then the big clincher was that George gets indicted for extortion after cavorting with the wife of a Mexican mafia guy over the
Well, this is better. This is better than anything that's in a novel, anyway.
Yeah, no, it's true. And then I, you know, at this time I've got, you know, several short stories going. I'm into the third short story, which is starting to turn into a novella. And now all of a sudden, you know, George is in jail, well on his way to federal prison. And there I am thinking, now what?
Well, you can't make this stuff up, right?
No. I mean, really, it was, but, you know, we had the issue of intellectual property rights, and now, you know, whose story is it? And half the time I'm, you know, making stuff up. And moreover, again, George is in trouble with the law, and my mother and he are separated, and so I'm not sure where I stand with
him. Oh, good grief.
Yeah, it was. At that moment, that was the first real, I mean, talk about barriers, that was the first big barrier, was I had invested so much time recording these different stories, and I had already invested just hundreds of hours in writing notes and researching and several short stories so far, and then this happens.
Well, can we back up for a second, Kelly? Your wife is fine now? Do you think that would this have happened if you had not had all that extra time? I mean,
that's a good point. Whether or not this would have happened had we not been in the accident, it's entirely possible not. I mean, you know, we would visit my mother, and she was living with George, and so I would have gotten to know him. So maybe had we not been in the accident, I still would have slowly been captivated by his stories. On the other hand, I may not have spent nearly as much time with him alone had, you know, and not been, you know, at doctor's appointments or in the hospital, you know, doing post-op, you know, and stuff like that. So that's a good question.
And you had no...
She's quite well.
Good. Glad to hear that. And you had no creative writing skills, but you, of course, did have to write scholarly articles and things like that for your PhD. So you weren't starting from scratch, but it was a whole different side of the brain.
Completely. I mean, everything that I'd written up until that point was indeed, you know, scholarly, insofar as I had to write a master's thesis and a doctoral dissertation. Then, of course, as a professor at Cal Poly, you know, research articles on, you know, clinical psychology and so on. But I never, I mean, never, ever thought nor aspired to write fiction. I mean, if someone would have told me, you know, during graduate school in the 80s that, you know, 10 years later I'd start crafting my first novel, I just would have said, okay, I got a diagnosis for you.
Hemingway said that there's nothing to writing. All you do is sit down at a typewriter and bleed. Do you think it's just the fact that most of us, you know, don't have the time or don't take the time to sit down and make it happen? What do you think stops us from the actual idea of writing down the stories we have in our heads?
God, I think there's so many things. I mean, the first thing to me and the most important one is desire. You know, for me, if it weren't a labor of love, if there wasn't passion in it for me, if it wasn't satisfying, even writing scholarly stuff, you know, I really enjoyed the process of writing, and, you know, my friends would laugh at me because I liked writing my master's thesis, and I liked writing my dissertation. If it's not something that is intrinsically satisfying, you know, then there's something else out there that is.
Well, you're right about, you have to enjoy either the process of writing or your topic, right? I mean, I've written a dissertation too, and if you don't like what you're writing about, it is gruesome. But
I always tell my students that they're always thinking about the quickest or the easiest way or the the most grand sort of project, and I always advise them, you know, wait a second, you know, pick something that you're interested in. You will enjoy it so much more. It'll be so much more satisfying and meaningful, you know.
Well, let's say that a person does have something meaningful and they do like writing. Would it take you about 6 months to write this book, Kelly?
Well, it could have. I mean, the first draft of the book that is now published, it actually initially started as A Duty to Warn. And I think I did have the first draft done It was less than a year, but, you know, I had help. I was on a sabbatical at the time, so I was able to, you know, I have more time than most people do to devote to it, so that helped. If, you know, you can have a lot of time on your hands and still not do anything, even if you want to, and that's where, you know, a number of other factors come into play, like literally scheduling the time to write. I never would have finished my master's thesis or my doctoral dissertation had I not crossed out certain times every single week where I was unavailable. No family, no girlfriends, no patients, no classes. It was writing time, and I treated that time like a class or like a patient hour.
That's a great idea. So
it's huge. So that was a habit that was that I initiated in graduate school. I don't know where the idea came from, but it worked.
So that takes care of one barrier, the time barrier, just schedule. I know that I've read stories about authors who have full-time jobs and get up 2 to 3 in the morning, and that's their writing time or whatever it might be. What about the fear that, you know, if I sit down and start to write it and I realize I'm no good, it's better to just talk about it than really do it. Do you think that that's a barrier for a lot of people?
Well, yeah, I think the fear of not being any good, that people won't like it, certainly can stop people from doing it. But again, you know, you got to ask why you're writing. And, you know, if it's intrinsically satisfying, if it really is meaningful, if it really is fun, if you have passion for it, I really believe this. I really trust that there will be someone out there, there will be a subgroup that responds in the reading of the book in the same way that it was to write it. In contrast, I think if people write out of obligation, duty, because they should, it shows up in the pages, and then it will bore people. They won't like it. But, you know, no one's going to write something that everyone likes. I mean, if you go onto Amazon and you look at, you know, anyone from Margaret Atwood or to John Grisham, you know, you're going to see a lot of their books. They're not all 5-starred. You know, they're 3.5 or 4-starred. So these people that are hugely successful still have a lot of people on there giving them negative reviews.
You know, we talk a lot on this show, of course, because it's No Barriers Radio. We talk about a lot of the barriers. And one of the things that seems to come up over and over again is most of the obstacles are things we put in our own way. And it's almost like people are afraid of, you know, being judged or putting their work out there to be judged because they might get those negative reviews.
Right. Well, this book, the first draft was written by fall of 96. The 7th, 8th draft was written by 2002. And at that point I had nearly 100, and I still have this file. In fact, I'm looking right at it. Of over 100, or roughly around 100 rejection letters.
100 rejection letters.
From literary agents from San Diego to New York City. Most of them, of course, in New York City. But, you know, they would say the story is about a psychologist who has an AIDS patient who won't tell his lovers he's got the virus. So hence, he is in this, what you know as a professional, too, is the duty to warn dilemma. You know, does he warn other people of his patient's illness, or does he keep the patient's illness confidential? And even in the mid-90s, people were in New York were saying, well, AIDS is passe. And I just about fell out of my chair thinking, well, tell that to the people who have it, you know. But they'd say that the topic is passe, or they'd say that it was too intense or too graphic, or that the characters weren't developed enough. The criticisms were endless, and some of them were, I mean, stinging brutal. I should have pulled a few in advance.
No, I don't want to make you relive that.
It's all right, you know, it's okay because they're, you know, it. In fact, I even got one agent at that time. She was really an A-list agent. and I'd written the second book by that time, and she read both, and she says, she calls up, I'll never forget this, this is 2003, she says, you're a good writer, you've got good ideas, but you're all over the place. She says, you need to take the same protagonist from book to book to book to book and develop a series. And I said, I don't want to do that. And I said, I'm monogamous in my marriage. I teach the same classes every year. I do psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I see the same patients, you know, week after week, month after month, year after year. I said, when I write, I want to write what I'm interested in. I want to lie, cheat, steal, philander, wander, travel. You know, I want to be an adventurer. And she says, well, that's not what I can sell. And I said, well, that's what I want to do. And she says, well, I can make you a lot of money if you'll just write a series. I said, I'm not writing for the money. I make, you know, a satisfactory living. Because it's a labor of love. I just felt like I would choke. I would die if I had to do it.
So you wanted to do it on your own terms.
Yes, and I wanted to do it because the joy of writing is in the creation. It's in, you know, seeing what comes next. It's that organic feeling of sitting down, like I started with George's stories, and all of a sudden, just in almost this out-of-body experience where all sorts of other ideas, characters, plot twists are just like, you know, literally coming off my fingertips. I don't know how else to describe it.
Well, somebody said that, you know, you don't necessarily see or read the best writers or see the best actors on, you know, movies or television. You see the people that can take bad reviews and lost auditions and take all these setbacks and just keep coming at it. And I was mentioning in your introduction, you were at this book total 19 years.
Yes. Well, and so actually when this agent said, well, then, you know, I can't represent you if you don't do it my way. And I said, okay, then I'm not going to be, then goodbye. And that was a tough one. That was really hard to hang that phone up. And then I got busy. We moved a few times. And I just, it's like almost as if without that creative outlet, I started doing all this other stuff. Like I started that wine shop that you know about. And I got into commercial real estate. And I became chair of the program. And all of these things that were, that sounded good on the surface, but were colossally unfulfilling. And I knew something was missing. And so when I took another sabbatical in 2011, I thought, okay, I'm going to rewrite this book again. I pulled out all those rejection letters. I pulled out a whole other file of other people who had read the book and provided their comments. And I created a great big matrix and identified all the criticisms. And I created a frequency distribution of how many times that criticism was levied. And so there definitely were themes. There were certain criticisms that were, you know, well represented among all those rejections, all those criticisms. And so those are the ones that I focused on. That's what I did in the rewrite. And 9 months later, I've got a publisher.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Now that's called stick.
Was instrumental. It was huge. And I am so grateful now. I can't tell you how grateful I am that this book wasn't published earlier, that earlier drafts weren't accepted. These people and their criticisms, they had something to offer me. And it's, you know, as I read the book now, I think, oh, God, I wish I could change this part.
Well, don't you think that's true about criticism, that many times we just, you know, we have thin skin and we kind of rail against it. But if we sit back, I don't know if I'm going to do a frequency distribution with mine, but if you sit back and really take it in, that you can learn something from it. Criticism doesn't have to be a barrier.
I tell people it was like massive group therapy. You know, when I do group therapy, I tell people before they start the group, I say, look, you know, if someone gives you some feedback and it's just one person, okay, well, maybe it might say more about them than you. I said, but the beauty of group therapy is if you hear the same thing from several people or a lot of people, then maybe it's something to take a look at. And so that's how I treated all these criticisms that I got, you know, from people over the years. And that, you know, when one criticism was levied, you know, a number of times from a variety of different people, then it was like, okay, this is something that I can benefit by.
Well, and plus, don't you think there's nothing like completing a dream, you know, completing a goal, doing what you set out to do, no matter how long it takes you?
Yes. And there was the temptation to self-publish, of course, because self-publishing really publisher, and I'm glad I did. I'm not going to, you know, I got my first royalty check a couple weeks ago.
Congratulations.
It was an eye-popping $54.
Hey, you know, but you're getting paychecks of a different kind.
Yes, and that, you know, and, you know, I have a great day job that, you know, affords me the luxury.
Well, now you know why so many writers live in little tool sheds out in the back of their mother's house.
Right, yeah. Or they have day jobs and they'll talk about getting up at, you know, 4 a.m. to write an hour before they go to the gym, or staying up late, which is what I did. I would write late at night, or just, you know, cram, you know, shoehorn things in the middle of the day and turn off the light in my office and shut the door and make it look like no one was home and, you know, write for 2 hours, you know.
So after 19 years and 100 rejection letters and multiple agents and a $54 royalty check, would you do it again?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm going to do it again. Like I said, I'll be on sabbatical next year, and I wrote a second book years ago that I think with the same approach, looking at the criticisms and really looking at the ones that are, you know, more frequent, and giving it one more good rewrite. And I think by mid-2017, I should have that one ready to go.
If you could tell someone who's listening today, who's always thought about writing a book, who's always thought they have a great idea, who just has never managed to do it, what's one piece of advice or final thought that you would like to give that person?
One piece is hard. There'd be many, but probably more than anything would be to create a schedule, block out the time. Without that, if you don't set up the frame, it's kind of like trying to build a house without a foundation, you know. So create a frame, bracket some time, create the space, because no one's going to create it for you.
Great. And what would you say to them about overcoming the barrier of fear or worthlessness or any of the things that stymie us from making our dreams come true? Do you have a piece of advice for our listeners about that?
It would be to take a look at who they're writing for. And if they're writing for other people, they might reconsider whether or not they want to write. If they're writing for themselves, to really look deep inside and what would be fun to write, what would be meaningful to write, what would be enjoyable, and then just trust, like everything else, there will be some people that love it, others that like it, some that, you know, feel so-so about it, and others that don't.
Well, and that's so great. That's so great, Kelly, because that's the thing about overcoming challenges and bouncing back is we really first have to do it for us.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that is so important. And that's where the meaning is. And then it's particularly joyful when someone else resonates with it, because then we're resonating together.
Very nice. Kelly Moreno, author of the new novel, the new 19-year-old novel, A Duty to Betray, which is available on Amazon and local bookstores.
Yes.
And we wish you will hurry up with that second book. I don't have 19 years to wait for that second book, Kelly.
Well, hopefully this one won't take nearly as long.
Thanks so much for being on No Barriers Radio.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Like I was saying, what you see on the New York Times bestseller lists are not necessarily the most talented writers. They're the most resilient. They overcame the barriers. They write. They work. They, as Hemingway said, sit in front of a typewriter or a keyboard and bleed. Jack London wrote on a tree stump. Voltaire and Cervantes wrote in prison. You can find the time. You can find the place. You've already got an idea. Put yourself in the seat and do it. At No Barriers, we know nothing worthwhile comes easily. Busting through obstacles, overcoming challenges, and chasing your dreams is tough stuff, but ah, the glory, the joy, the adrenaline that greets you when you finally finished, even if, like Kelly Moreno, it took almost 2 decades. Take a No Barriers pledge today at nobarriersusa.org. Whether to write a book, climb a mountain, be a better parent, you can do it, whatever it is, and we can help you.